Jason Horsley for the Liminalist, the podcast between. This is the season finale, so to speak, a codex, whatever the right term is. The 70th podcast with Paul Sader was the last conversation I recorded before the passing of Garbanzo, which was 6 weeks ago today on the 12th of May 2016. I have recorded conversations since that time, so season two of the Liminalist will begin next week. But nonetheless, I wanted to mark the transition, the changing of the ages, the equinox, indeed, of my life, one of them, which is Garbanzo's passing. However and why ever, that did prove to be, has proved, is proving to be such a monumental shift internally and externally. I have begun dreaming about Garbanzo. There were dreams about him early on, but they were of a quite strange quality to them, that it wasn't actually Garbanzo, it was this being that... And I wasn't really able to remember the dreams. And then this week I had a dream in which I met Garbanzo in the forest where I was naked, and Alistair Crowley was also there, and I had a conversation with Crowley about Garbanzo and why he was so important to me, as well as about Crowley's abort failed attempt to create a new religion and stuff like that. That will be in the Garbanzo Crowley book that I'm working on whenever that should see the light, if it does. Many books I write don't, but anyway, that's not meant to tantalize you. Well, maybe it is, but I'm just trying to give a little background to the statement I made, which was that I have begun dreaming about Garbanzo in a way that is more conventional, perhaps, but more comforting, let's say. Last night I dreamt that I was holding him and stroking him, and he was purring. And I don't really think Garbanzo is a cat. Well, I don't know, but I don't really know what the nature of these latest dreams are. The one before that, the night before that, I dreamt that he climbed on the bed. My wife and I, and we were just astonished. Like, what are you doing here? You're dead. Kind of dream. So very realistic. Although I imagine we'd have been a lot more astonished than we were in the dream, if that should have happened. But there seems to be some sort of reconciliation going on within myself through this process of grieving, by which I'm able to experience a connection to Garbanzo that is emotional as well as energetic. Obviously the energetic connection continued, and if anything deepened through the process of grieving. Not that that wasn't emotional, but I mean just in terms of feeling that Garbanzo is still with me in a different way that is emotionally reassuring, as opposed to just cosmically confirming, let's say. So I'm not sure where I was going with that. I decided to do a sort of transitional podcast this week rather than moving right into season two of the Liminalist. I hadn't decided it would be that until now. Which is with Venetia Campbell, and there's a discussion of Garbanzo and the whole story around that. Well, not the whole story, of course, but some of the key points. I decided to do this transitional podcast. Why did I? I can't even remember. Oh, I know, because I found an audio from 5 years ago that I'd made for no one, Well, I was listening to old audios from 5 years ago, and I thought that it would be worth sharing. So then I decided to build a mini podcast around that audio, and just make a direct address to listeners, readers, etc. In terms of taking the temperature, so to speak, of the podcast and getting the lay of the land, like where I'm at, where we've been, where this is going, although that latter is a little trickier. I thought that I would have more to say. When I was coming home today from yoga, and this morning I had, as well as the Garbanzo Dream, which was a kind of a little loving interlude in the midst of a whole series of astral lucid dreaming, for 2 hours this morning, coming in and out of consciousness in such a way that I don't think I've ever experienced such sustained lucidity before. Now I think about it, there was nothing dark in there. There were no. In the past, there's always been a me going after sexual gratification, one form or another, at some point or another, and that didn't happen. But that wasn't what I was going to say. That was a digression of a digression. I was coming back from yoga, and I know why I mentioned the dreaming, because in yoga, I was at the end of yoga. I started to think, well, if that's what non-physical existence can be like, then I might start looking forward to death. And then on my way home, I was thinking about death and something I'd just read. I used to think it was Crowley, of all people, good God. Anyway, because of course I've been having to immerse myself in Crowley again, and distasteful as it's been, it certainly seems to be a fruitful process for me in this journey inward and downward to the core and to the roots. About death being the equivalent of winter, and well, one of the problems with death is that anything we say about it is likely to be a platitude and just inadequate, insufficient to counter the stark emotional reality of it, the wrenching emotional reality of death and of saying goodbye physically to everyone and everything that we cherish, starting and ending with our bodies, if we do cherish them. But what I was thinking, at least, if not knowing, was how we're always here, one form or another, whether we're alive or dead. And it would seem that we're more alive than dead, as in, I mean, there's that saying that we die only once, but for such a long time. And so, in the context of this identity, we are dead, or non-existent even, for a hell of a lot longer than we're here. Like, this identity of Jason Horsley is fleeting to the point of infinitesimality. And so it does seem as though, yes, we're dead a lot more than we're alive, infinitely more. But that's from the point of view of this mental identity or this physical form. And so there's nothing to say that we don't continue in other, through other identities and through other forms, without using the R word. But in either case, We continue to exist in whatever form. And the proof is that we're here right now, speaking, listening, whatever. Despite the fact that this is happening within the context of endless time, without beginning, without end. We are actually here in this moment, so we must always have been here and we must always be here. And in terms of the natural seasons and cycles, we have spring, the childhood, we have summer, we have our adulthood, and we have autumn, we have old age, and then there's this fourth season in which we don't exist at all, like all the plants die and everything shuts down and it's covered with snow and ice, and it's like there's no life there at all. But that's an illusion. The life still exists under the frozen ground, and it's just waiting. It's just waiting for the sun to return, to re-emerge in new forms. And yet, even those new forms are a continuation of the old forms. And think of trees. Well, the tree itself doesn't die. It hibernates like a bear sleeping in the mountains. So it seems as though that's what we are too. That's the natural cycles of consciousness. And I think if there's any single thing that Gobanza's passing has allowed me to see in a deep enough way to begin to embody the seeing of it, it's this. It's that death is not the end. Or that nothing really dies. Not really. And although there is a terrible hole in my life, that when it's at its worst, the emotional pain of it, when it's at its worst, it does feel as though my life has been stripped of meaning, or stripped of joy, or stripped of something absolutely essential to its functioning. It feels like that emotionally, and the thoughts, or at least the thoughts that accompany that or arise from the emotional anguish of losing Gobanza are of that nature, that life has no meaning without him. And I laugh because it is absurd. Gobanza wasn't the meaning of my life, but what he was is it was the center of my emotional being, or the way in which I experienced that center outside of me. That was an email coming in from Gobanza, actually from Gary Height. So this is one more tribute to Gobanza and the magnificence that he was and that he continues to be in ways that are hidden and mysterious to me, in a large part, but somewhat visible and somewhat tangible and ongoing. And so if anything, my life has become more meaningful for being able to see that meaning is not contingent on the experience of the senses. So I was going to talk just more about the podcast and stuff, I thought, but that didn't happen. Maybe there isn't much to say. If there is, I'll say it later. I'm going to transition now into this audio after a musical break, which was recorded, as I said, for no one, late at night in Guatemala. This was after, this was in 2011, and it was a couple of months after I had left Canada and my wife with Garbanzo, traveled together to Guatemala and set up abode in this very, as I say, empirical, empire-like, this kingdom, housing complex by the river. It's not as nice as it sounds because the river dries up mostly in Guatemalan summer. Outside of Panajachel. And I was in it was a very, very difficult time. I thought the marriage was over, and although I was still hoping that my wife would come and join me in Guatemala at some point, but more and more it just seemed as though the whole thing was over. And what I think this audio demonstrates, one of the reasons I felt like it was worth sharing, is how there does seem to be a correlation, in my life at least, between reaching bottom and giving up or losing all sense of hope and meaning and just being in the deepest doldrums, and a clear transmission, a clear, honest, accurate expression of perception of reality.
Horrendous abyss. Everything is meaningless. Everything is completely meaningless, including this crisis of meaninglessness. This is death. I don't see in your rebirth. Don't even believe in rebirth anymore. All the systems of knowledge are failing me. There's nothing left to do anymore except carry on just mechanically doing what has to be done to keep myself healthy and apparently sane. It's all that's left, because to act upon this feeling would be insanity, destruction, self-destruction, destruction of others. Completely useless to myself or to anyone else. But what's most useless of all is the uselessness of self-pity and that awareness of how useless I am. That then becomes beyond useless, it becomes negative, destructive, polluting, indulgent, it's like if everything is meaningless and I am completely useless, then the only thing really left is to do the impossible, which is to enjoy life and to manifest vitality and optimism and good cheer, because it doesn't matter anyway. I mean, it doesn't matter that I'm useless. It's meaningless anyway. So there's no internet. Which is probably a good thing. So I've reached an impasse with Michelle, and in the same moment, almost the same afternoon, I had this very heartfelt reconciliation with Eos, a reunion. So it's a very peculiar set of developments. It comes to Michelle, I become so acutely aware of my vengeful, hostile, hateful side, even though it's not coming out, and it's not as though I'm plotting or scheming, it's not that it's strong in me, it's just that it's there, and I don't see it diminishing or dissolving. It feels as though and part of me is going to be angry with Michelle forever. Like I'll never be able to let go of that anger. So I guess that's how I perceive her too, to me. It's just like we've got this revenge-driven relationship now. And yet it's very subtle. But the fact that it's there just seems to me to be terminal, like a worm in an apple kind of thing. Like you just have to throw away the whole apple. But on the other hand, I don't know really. It feels like it's more than just the apple, but every other apple has to go with it. If I were to abandon this relationship and admit failure, feels as though I would also be opting to be alone thereafter, because not that I would, I wouldn't reject the possibility of another relationship, but it does feel like if I can't actually overcome this or break this conundrum or whatever the fuck has to happen, then it's just something in me that isn't functioning. Just not actually capable of being that intimate with another without needing to control them. It's too threatening. I don't want to think that's a universal thing. I used to think all of this is just part of an alchemical relationship, just as I used to think that falling apart and crisis and despair was all part of individuation or awakening. But I don't believe that anymore. I think it's all just a trick, and then it just keeps on going forever. So we get tricked into suffering, and so we think we're actually getting somewhere by suffering. But all we're getting to is more and more suffering. And then we die. And that's our life, and it's utterly meaningless. But it doesn't matter that it's meaningless, because there's no meaning to it. It doesn't mean anything, it's being meaningless, so. Then it's really just a choice of to cling to that sense of meaninglessness, or just to let it go and accept that if there is some sort of meaning, then I'm not capable of understanding it. I can't reap any benefits from that meaning. The only benefits for me are the moment-to-moment benefits of the enjoyment of being alive. And as long as I'm focusing internally on my thoughts and feelings, then there isn't any enjoyment. It's just a continuous torment. but I'm really angry with, well, God, really, the universe, but for allowing me to invest all of this meaning into something that doesn't really exist. So then it feels like I've got something I've got to cling to and protect, and yet it doesn't even have any meaning. I've given it meaning. Because I have the power to do that. But it's an illusion. Well, loving is real. That energy of love seems to be real, but all of the pain that it causes then also becomes real. I don't know how to love without suffering, but I don't know how not to love. And there's nothing, that is the only meaning that I know, is the fact that I love, I'm capable of loving, and I mean, not as an action, I don't think I'm really capable of being loving, or at least in a very diminished capacity, but of experiencing love within myself. Well, it's a very limited capacity, I suppose, but it's enough that I can detect it. I can follow the thread. I don't lose touch with love. For very long. During the day, I suppose. And then again, pain's so great that then anger is a way to block out the pain. Anger at the one we love for not being easy to love, for exposing our inadequacies in loving, not that they're doing that, but just the more that we love them, the more inadequate we realize ourselves to be, and then the more pain there is in that, the more anger we could feel, and it's a vicious circle. I don't know. The solution is, if it's not possible to stop loving, we can just stay away from people that one loves. And that definitely will. That doesn't seem a good option either. It's like try and avoid suffering, it means I'm really going to suffer in this regard. And then on the other hand, because I'm clinging to the other person or the idea of being with them, that's also to avoid suffering. There's really no way out situation. It's nightmarish. It's really nightmarish, and it's just become much more so since I've ceased to be able to tell myself that this is all evolutionary. That it's allowing me to let go of stuff and open, and I'm feeling this terrible because something's really happening in me, and well, I mean, I still do believe that, but I don't really believe that I believe it. I mean, I can't really. I feel like it would be better if I didn't believe it. Because that's just one last straw to cling to in the midst of this, to keep me from going under.
I didn't go under when I went to Finland, and did a series of retreats with Devashana, and came back to Guatemala, and then moved back to Canada with Gabanzo and rejoined my wife. There was something that I thought was relevant about Gobanzo and his passing. Gobanzo was there throughout that recording. You can't hear him, unfortunately. I mean, it'd be nice if he was purring or something, but I'm pretty sure he was there on the bed throughout. And it struck me how relatively content I am now compared to then, even though back then I had Gobanzo with me. And so it's not as simple as how little I appreciate Gobanzo. I absolutely appreciate him. It's just the proof that no kind of external object of love is enough to really fulfill or satisfy or nourish or nurture us. It can only come from within. And so even though Garbanzo was with me throughout that period, it didn't, not that it didn't help, but it didn't prevent me from spiraling down into those deep, deep places of despair, where of course I had to go. And something else that struck me about what I'm talking about there in terms of intimacy and how love leads to pain because of whatever I described there in that last audio, that dynamic that we end up locked inside of when we're in a relationship with somebody, how that didn't apply with Garbanzo, because there were no conditions. What Garbanzo provided me with was an unconditional receiver and giver of love. Whenever I needed to feel love and to feel loved, I could go to Garbanzo. There were times where I was angry with him, and times where I was indifferent to him, but essentially my prevailing response to him was one of love, and that was his prevailing response to me. We were in love together, so to speak. And of course that was dependent on there not being any of those intersecting patterns of trauma. Not that Garbanzo wasn't traumatized, but he was a cat. So whatever his trauma was, it didn't match mine. It matched it in a weird way, in that he was an extension of me, which of course is what, and I was an extension of him, which is what we aspire to in a marriage, I think, what I do, anyway, is to merge with the other. Well, Garbanzo and I, in a sense, we were merged. Like, he emerged from the same place I emerged. He was my familiar. He was an aspect of my totality. So the patterns matched in a perfect way, in the sense that they would superimpose rather than interlock. So it wasn't that his teeth matched my wound, but that our wounds matched and our teeth matched. And so, yeah, we would get head-to-head sometimes. I'd get angry with him, he'd get angry with me, but it never became that battle of wills that leads to all kinds of blame and recrimination, resentment, and disappointment, and all that, because we could always just return to that basic pulse of his purr and my caress, and that deep abiding love between us, which was unchanged by anything he did. Neither of us bore grudges against the other ever. So. My relationship with Garbanzo, the reason I think, or one of the reasons I was able to experience it so deeply, was that I've forgotten what I was going to say there. It's weird, it just went out of my thoughts. One of the reasons that I was able to love Garbanzo so deeply was... I guess maybe because be damned for a dog. It's not about reasons. But anyway, what I was trying to express is... Well, actually, I don't even know that either. What am I trying to express? If you're going to say it, mean it. Be it. be what you want to say. It was thought out beforehand, so it probably wasn't no longer relevant. I guess it has to do with that I didn't suffer as a result of Garbanzo. He didn't cause me suffering except on those occasions that he went missing, went away for hours and occasionally for days at a time, and there was an incident in Guatemala. During this period that he did disappear for, must have been 24 hours, it was a day and a night, and I just, maybe I got up in the morning and he was gone, and then he didn't come back for the whole day, and I was just, it had never happened before. And I was convinced that he had been killed, or that he'd got trapped, or something had happened, because he never, since he was neutered anyway, he never went away for long periods of time. And because the property was so large and it wasn't fenced in, he could go deep into the forest, the jungle, and there was no way to really look for him if he didn't want to be found, or if he was hurt in a way that he couldn't make a sound or I couldn't hear him. So it was a very distressing situation, and I had a minor breakdown in which I thought I'd lost Garbanzo along with everything else. This was the year that I lost my mother. Well, my mother died anyway. Well, I lost her somewhere and couldn't find her, but it is like that too. My brother died 2 months before that, and then I lost my guru, so to speak. I realized that I didn't want to follow John DeReiter anymore, and then Sweater came to an end, so I lost the business that I'd set up, and then the marriage effectively ended. So it was just like everything was ending that year. And when I thought that I'd lost Garbanzo too, I really, really felt I couldn't go on. And I said as much to the gods, and I just collapsed on the ground and wailed and said, I can't do it, I can't, I just can't do it anymore. And he did reappear some hours later. I was talking to Mitch about it on the phone and just saying, he's gone, and I looked around and he was sitting by his food bowl waiting for food, and I hadn't heard him come in, and I thought I was hallucinating, which later did happen. I did get up in the night once and see him by his food bowl and then look around and look back, and he was gone, and he was on the bed the whole time. So, but on this occasion he actually had returned, and I never found out where he'd been. He was unhurt, and I thought after that he had, this actually caused a shift in my perception of my wife and the marriage, the whole situation, somehow like a letting go, and I felt able to let go of certain amount of recrimination and bitterness, and I'm pretty sure it was the next day that I painted a thank you painting for my wife, and that did cause a shift, and so I thought, even before that, I thought Garbanzo had gone like that to show me something, as a response to something in me, and he'd waited until I'd gone through something that I needed to go through, which was just incredibly intense distress and suffering. But that was the exception. Basically, as compared to a relationship with my wife, where I felt that she was constantly causing me to suffer, hence all the recrimination, blame, disappointment, frustration, resentment. Garbanzo, there was none of that, and until he died. And then when he died, it was like all of that love didn't turn into recrimination or resentment or bitterness, although I think there must be a tiny, tiny sliver of that, but it did turn into suffering and pain. Uh, and a sense of abandonment. When Gopinatha died, I felt that I lost the only real friend I had, the only one I could go to and just be with and who would understand me no matter what. So I just felt so crushingly lonely, and I still do. I feel like there's nobody I can go to with the pain of his passing. There's nobody who will understand it. Which is true, of course. Nobody's going to feel it the way I feel it. And of course that's the fearful symmetry of that, is that the one person who would understand that pain isn't there, because that's the reason for the pain, that they're not there. So there's a letting go into something that has to happen through that passing. And hence I felt that I needed to let go of this podcast and everything else. I mean, the podcast is the most overt and obvious expression of my purpose and my expression. Whatever. Anyway, I was just trying to tie that neatly back to the podcast. I could bring it to more practical focus as to why this anomalous podcast, just to mark that transition for myself and for everyone else, because of course I do want to communicate and convey as much as possible the depth of this change, how catastrophic and how rich in meaning it is to me. And certainly since that time described in 2011 when everything came to an end and I thought even Gopinatha was gone, well, not that that was the reason for that, the depression I was in that audio anyway, but compared to that time, I'd say my life is very vibrant with meaning. Even though I still have days and hours and many, many thoughts that reflect that same kind of existential ennui of what is it all for. I mean, one of the things this podcast is describing and mapping, I guess, is my process of conscious dismantling of systems of belief, of illusions, of all that stuff that I recognized back then, when everything started ending, one thing after another, everything around me was ending, family members and gurus and partners and lifestyles and all the rest of it, that this was true of everything. Everything was going to fall away. And shit. Well, it is a tough struggle. I'm not going to pretend it isn't. But I did realize after Gopinatha left very quickly that, unlike back in 2011, the various elements of my life were solid and firmly established, and like a kind of technology really around me that was working very fluently, and that there was no reason to dismantle it or shut it down, my life, the podcast, the blog, the writing, Crowley piece, the thrift store, my marriage, the house, the garden, all these different activities that have a momentum of their own. Everybody knows how that is, well, unless they're on heroin and just lying around the apartment all day long. Even then, there are basic needs that take over. But that, of course, can be completely soulless and soul-destroying. And where I felt pretty clearly after Gabanz had passed, when potentially everything could have just suddenly seemed empty and hollow and meaningless, and in a certain sense did, my life was very full of soul, was very full of life. My life was full of life. Well, the things that I had arranged around me were enlivened. They wanted my attention. Not that they were demanding it like little vampiric children, but like a garden that was in bloom and that was drawing me to attend it. So I did continue the podcast almost without missing a beat. But it is different now. It has to be different. And hence, though the small superficial changes don't amount to much, then they do represent a deeper internal change, which, as far as I know, has something to do with reconnecting to a primal part of me that previously I was living through my cat to have a sense of. And that is one of the things I miss the most about Gabanzo. I think maybe the thing is that his substance, his presence was so grounding to me. I mean, he would literally sit on my lap and I would pick him up and put him on my lap, because I could always tell when he wanted to be there, and then he would just stay there, and he just felt such a warm, solid weight there, and I couldn't do anything once he was on my lap, unless I happened to have a book nearby or something. And I would just feel the well-being that he was feeling, being there on my lap, and our shared well-being of being together like that. And that was true of most everything he did. When I would watch him and observe him and be with him, he was always transmitting that very pure primal essence of life, that there is no substitute for. There's no way to fake it or make it. It's just, it's either there or it isn't, and in fact it's always there. Just that we stay out of it, we stay out of that primal transmission that wants to come through us and just fill our lives to the brim. So it felt as though, after he left, it felt as though my life had emptied out, because Gabanzo had filled it. His presence had filled it, but of course that wasn't true. He was one of many relationships in my life, animate and inanimate. So what was filling it was my love for him, or my love generally, and it's just that I was able to feel it more acutely in his presence, the subtle simplicity and the power of love. And the essence of it, that at the most fundamental level, that is all that I am. Anyway, this has been a Transitional Liminalist podcast, a podcast between the podcast between. I think I already said that, so I'm repeating my jokes already. I must be getting old. I am getting old. It's the truth of it. 49 this year. 7 times 7. I don't know if there's anything else to add, really. The opening song in this podcast was composed by French Radio, which he was kind enough to squeeze out of his sausage factory when I told him about Garbanzo and kind of hinted, or maybe I just asked him, can you do a song? And it's called Cat Gone Song. The lyrics, because they're kind of hard to hear, are something like, three legs is dead, three legs is dead. And yes, he is. He's rejoined his missing leg, cast off the old coat, and moved into greater, deeper dimension of existence, where we all exist together, believe it or not. This is Jason Horsley still, again, and Garbanzo, for the Limitless, the podcast between. Thanks so much for sticking it out to the bittersweet end.